Chapter 6. The afternoon had now hotted up to quite a marked extent, and what with a substantial lunch and several beakers of port, I was more or less in the condition a python gets into after its midday meal. A certain drowsiness had stolen over me, so much so that twice in the course of my narrative the aged R had felt compelled to notify me that if I didn't stop yawning in her face, she would let me have one on the side of my fat head with the parasol with which she was shielding herself from the rays of the sun. There had been no diminution of this drowsiness since last heard of, and as I bowled along the high road I was practically in dreamland, and it occurred to me that if I didn't pause somewhere and sleep it off, I should shortly become a menace to pedestrians and traffic. The last thing I wanted was to come before my late host in his magisterial capacity, charged with having struck some citizen amidships while under the influence of his port. Colonel Briscoe's port, I mean, not the citizen's. Embarrassing for both of us, though in a way a compliment to the excellence of his cellar. The high road, like most high roads, was flanked on either side by fields, some with cows, some without. So, the day being as warm as it was, just dropping anchor over here or over there meant getting as cooked to a crisp as Major Plank would have been had the widows and surviving relatives of the late chief of the Mgombis established connection with him. What I wanted was shade, and by great good fortune I came on a little turning leading to wooded country, just what I needed. I drove into this wooded country, stopped the machinery, and it wasn't long before sleep poured over me in a healing wave, as the expression is. It started off by being one of those dreamless sleeps, but after a while a nightmare took over. It seemed to me that I was out fishing with E. Jimpson Murgatroyd in what appeared to be tropical waters, and he caught a shark, and I was having a look at it when it suddenly got hold of my arm. This, of course, gave me a start, and I woke. And as I opened my eyes, I saw that there was something attached to my portside biceps, but it wasn't a shark. It was Orlo Porter.
"I beg your pardon, sir," he was saying, "for interrupting your doze, but I'm a bird-watcher. I was watching a Clarkson's warbler in that thicket over there, and I was afraid your snoring might frighten it away, so might I beg you to go easy on the sound effects? Clarkson's warblers are very sensitive to loud noises, and you were making yourself audible a mile off."
Or words to that general import. I would have replied, "Oh, hello," or something like that, but I was too astonished to speak, partly because I had never suspected that Orlo Porter could be so polite, but principally because he was there at all. I had looked on Maiden Eggersford as somewhere where I would be free from all human society, a haven where I would have peace, perfect peace, with loved ones far away, as the hymn book says, and it was turning out to be a sort of meeting place of the nations. First Plank, then Vanessa Cook, and now Orlo Porter. If this sort of thing was going to go on, I told myself, I wouldn't be surprised to see my Aunt Agatha come round the corner, arm in arm with E.J. Murgatroyd. Orlo Porter seemed now to recognise me, for he started like a native of India who sees a scorpion in his path, and went on to say,
"Worcester, you blasted, slimy, creeping, crawling serpent, I might have expected this."
It was plain that he was not glad to see me, for there was nothing affectionate in what he said or the way he said it, but apart from that I was unable to follow him. He had me at a loss. "Expected what?" I asked, hoping for footnotes.
"That you would have followed Vanessa here, your object to steal her from me."
This struck me as so absurd that I laughed a light laugh, and he asked me to stop cackling like a hen whose union had been blessed, or laying a blasted egg, as he preferred to put it. "I haven't followed anyone anywhere," I said, trying to pour oil on the troubled W's. I debated with myself whether to add old man, and decided not.
I doubt if it would have had much effect anyway. "Then why are you here?"
he demanded in a voice so fortissimo that it was obvious that he didn't give a damn if Clarkson's warbler heard him and legged it in a panic. I continued suave. "The matter is susceptible of a ready explanation," I said. "You remember those spots of mine?"
"Don't change the subject."
"I wasn't. Having inspected the spots, the doc advised me to retire to the country."
"There are plenty of other places in the country to retire to."
"Ah," I said, "but my aunt, Dahlia, is staying with some people here, and I knew it would make all the difference if I had her to exchange ideas with. Very entertaining woman, my Aunt Dahlia. Never a dull moment when she's around." This, as I had foreseen, had him stymied. Something of his belligerence left him, and I could see that he was saying to himself, "Can it be that I have wronged Bertram?" Then he clouded over again.
"All this is very plausible," he said, "but it does not explain why he was slinking round Eggersford Court this morning."
I was amazed. When I was a child, my nurse told me that there was one who was always besides me, spying out all my ways, and that if I refused to eat my spinach, I would hear all about it on Judgment Day. But it never occurred to me that she was referring to Orlo Porter. "How on earth do you know that?" I said, or perhaps gasped would be a better word, or even gurgled. "I was watching the place through my bird-watching binoculars, hoping to get a glimpse of the woman I love." This gave me the opportunity to steer the conversation into less controversial topics. "I'd forgotten you were a bird-watcher till you reminded me just now. You went in for it at Oxford, I remember. It isn't a thing I would care to do myself. Not, I hasten to add, that I've anything against bird-watching. Must be most interesting. Besides keeping you, I was about to say, out of the public houses, but thought it better to change it to out in the open air. What's the procedure?" I said. "I suppose you lurk in a bush till a bird comes along, and then you out with the glasses and watch it." I had more to say, notably a question as to who Clarkson was and how he came to have a warbler, but he interrupted me.
"I won't tell you why you were sneaking round Eggersford Court this morning. It was in the hope of seeing Vanessa."
I no-noed, but he paid no attention.
"And I would like to say for your guidance, Worcester, that if I catch you trying to inflict your beastly society on her again, I shall have no hesitation in tearing your insides out."
He started to walk away, paused, added over his shoulder the words, "with my bare hands," and was gone. Whether or not to resume watching Clarkson's warbler, I had no means of knowing. My own feeling was that any level-headed bird with sensitive ears would have removed itself almost immediately after he'd begun to speak.